Welcome to Happily Family. I'm Cecilia Hilke.
And I'm Alana Hilke.
She's our 17-year-old daughter, and we are here together to welcome and interview Julie Lithcott-Hames. Julie is the New York Times bestselling author of How to Raise an Adult. She also authored Real American, her award-winning memoir about her experience as a Black and biracial person in white spaces. And her third book, Your Turn, How to Be an Adult, was just released this month. Julie is a mother, former Stanford dean, and corporate lawyer. Welcome, Julie. It's great to have you here.
Cecilia and Alana, it is great to be with you. I always love being a part of your community. I'm delighted to be back.
Awesome. Well, it's great to have you. And I wanted to start off with a question. You've written now two books that have a theme, maybe even three books that have a theme of self-direction. One was how parents can raise self-directed kids. One was about how your turn, how young adults can be more self-directed. And I'm curious about how you and your life learned how to be self-directed yourself.
Wow, what a beautiful question and an enormous question. I'm 53. Throughout much of my adolescence and young adulthood, I was desperately interested in doing what other people thought I should do, which is not unique to me. Many of us struggle with that. And so my particular journey included that. I was just focused on what does society value? What do my peers value? What do my parents and extended family expect? Let me go be and do those things. And ultimately, I became authentically self-directed. I mean, when I was Alana's age, I would have said, oh, I'm doing what I want to do. It's just that what I wanted to do was what I thought would win me the approval of others. Okay. I finally got to an age and stage where I could say, you know what? What I actually know to be true about this spirit, this being, this life is X, Y, and Z. I am going to give myself permission to be that person, even if people think it's silly, or even if they wonder, why are you making that career choice? Or why are you doing this? I got to a place in my 30s, I think, where I was finally content with what I knew to be true about myself. It wasn't about pleasing others anymore. It was about just trying to honor and grow whatever skills, whatever talents I might possess, and so that I could be of use to my fellow humans through my work. So I guess I became self-directed in my late 30s. When I came to love myself, I spent years not loving my Black and biracial self. And I really did a lot of work to come out from under that internalized oppression, that sense of you're not good enough. You have to prove, that you are worthy of respect from the mainstream white community. I just did that psychological work and came to peace with who I am and this place of self-love. And I think, self-love and self-direction, they probably go together. If you're not loving yourself as you are, it's hard to really follow your own sense of the direction in which you want to be headed. So that's when it all started to come together for me.
One of the questions that Alana and I have talked about when we're reading your book is that you've had this interesting career path as a lawyer and then a dean and now a writer, author, speaker. How did you know at each point when it was time to make a change and shift?
Well, the first change was just a change made because I was miserable. I was a well-paid, very well-paid, successful young corporate lawyer who was being mentored and given opportunity. I mean, it all looked amazing, right? Like, wow. And I got applause from my family and from my peers, like, ooh, Julie's a corporate lawyer. I had the fancy Ann Taylor suits and I had the leather briefcase from Coach and I'd go to work every day to my important job. And it just turns out that I didn't go to law school to be a corporate lawyer. I went to law school to help humans who are struggling, humans who need an advocate, humans who are underserved, humans who are trampled upon. That was the value that took me off to this very challenging, rigorous situation known as law school. The trouble is, I was so insecure in my early 20s and through my 20s, but in law school in my early 20s, I was so insecure so needing as a Black woman to prove to them who I thought were judging me, they, society, I needed to prove, hey, I'm smart. I did well. You know, I was kind of in the middle of my class at law school, which embarrassed me, like, oh, I have to show that I'm, you know, and so I have to go get one of those corporate offers to prove that I'm smart. And so I got a number of corporate offers and I chose a lovely corporate law firm to work at. The trouble was the work was just supporting corporations in their battle against other corporations. There was nothing about helping the marginalized, underserved humans. And so I was well paid and well regarded and being given opportunity and desperately unhappy. And my blood pressure was high at work, which my doctor was concerned about. And I would have a knot in my stomach every Sunday afternoon at the thought of going back. And so I had this cognitive dissonance of I'm so successful by some measures, and yet I'm so unhappy. And it was in that deep, desperate misery that I was able to locate some truths about myself that I had been ignoring. So I think the lesson there is, often we need to be miserable. Like we need to say like, oh, I have high blood pressure. My doctor wants me to quit this job. Or I was talking to someone the other day. She's like, my hair was falling out. I was so stressed at my job. Sometimes we need the hair to be falling out or the high blood pressure to legitimize our unhappiness. Our body is literally saying, stop this now. And that becomes the evidence we can give ourselves permission around, like, okay, we'll make a change. The change for me from academia into writing was coming out of this burgeoning, it wasn't coming out of misery. I was in my 40s. I had been doing a lot of writing for pleasure. I had been writing poetry. I had been writing song lyrics. I had been writing the occasional essay about things that mattered to me. Coming out of a history of not being a good writer. I was given feedback in college and high school that my writing was not very good. I was fine, but I wasn't a good writer. And yet I was turning to writing as a way to know myself and understand my experience better. And I said to my partner, Dan, this human I've walked along the path of life with for now 33 years, we met in college as 19 and 20 year olds. I said to him, Listen to how tenuous this statement is. I think I might want to try to do something with my writing, I said to him. Okay, to go from that, like, I think I might want to try to do something with my writing to, wow, I'm about to publish, I have published my third book. I have given a TED Talk that has millions of views based on that book. Like, I've turned that into something. It was a desire. So if I left corporate law out of misery, I became a writer as my third kind of act out of a deeper knowing of my own capabilities and how I wanted to try to be of use. I loved working with students. I love helping young people on their path and listening well and just trying to shine a light for people so they can see their own lives more clearly. And I think I thought that writing might be a way for me to just spread that love farther.
Yeah. And what I'm hearing are themes about self-love, self-direction, listening to our own internal wisdom, our own voice, not listening to those often louder voices of people outside of us, in our family or culture, society, tuning in. And I think that would you say that that's one of the themes of your turn?
100%. There's a chapter in there. It's actually chapter 5, but it was the first chapter I wrote because sometimes you don't know the shape your book is going to take. I struggled to write this book for 3 years. I'd accepted a contract, in which I agreed to write this book, but then I couldn't find my way in. I couldn't figure out how to write it. And finally, I wrote this chapter, stop pleasing others. They have no idea who you are. And that turned out to be the voice that the book would take on. And in it, I talk about the noise in our heads of other people's expectations, the noise of parents, the noise of society, the noise of grandparents, the noise of peers. Sometimes it's our peers who laugh at us. You know, our peers, particularly if they're techie peers, if they're engineering types, and we are like psychology or anthropology or history. They're like, oh, that's silly. Oh, that's easy. And our peers can often make us feel really ashamed or foolish about choosing what we want. Theater, you know, what's that? Well, you know, so I try in that chapter, as I did as a dean in office hours with students, to say, you know what? We got to get better at listening for our own voice. Our own voice is in there. And the better we can get it, it's almost like tuning on an old-fashioned radio in the car sense, you know, like tuning in the right station. You want to, there's all this noise of everyone else's expectations. I call it a cacophony, a very loud noise of what I ought to do and what I should do. And I will be loved if I do, right? All of that is noise. We got to tune in our own voice that is, will get louder and louder. The more we listen for it, the better we get at listening for it, the louder it'll be. And then we have to find the courage to honor it. So my voice is telling me, you know, I want to do X. Okay, what is it going to take to actually be the person who heads in that direction?
So taking that sometimes large step to listen to yourself and what yourself is telling you to do can sometimes be a really scary thing to do. What's your advice for getting over that fear and plunging into that big step?
Oh, yeah, Alana, it's definitely scary. Okay, yes, you're 100% right about that. However, on the other side of scary is amazing. Okay, so there are three zones that they talk about in Global Citizen Year, which is an amazing gap year company that I used to be on the board of. They talk about the comfort zone, the panic zone, and in the middle, the growth zone. Okay, so the comfort zone is how you feel when you're on your parents' couch watching a wonderful television show. Okay, you're comfortable, you're safe, you might even have some snacks nearby, but you're not really learning and growing unless it's a very engrossing documentary. Okay, your panic zone is like, oh my gosh, I might actually die. This is not just emotionally terrifying, but maybe there's a cliff here that I might fall off. Like, I'm terrified. We're not aiming for that. We're aiming for the growth zone. Okay, you got to get out of your comfort zone into the growth zone of like, well, I want to try this. I'm going to see what happens. And it's not going to kill me, but it's a stretch for me because it's not comfortable. We only grow in our comfort zone. You don't grow sitting on the couch usually. Okay. So we have to be willing to kind of, all right, let me just get out there a little bit and try this. And if we can take a beginner's mentality instead of a perfectionist mentality, that is a great coping mechanism. If you leave your comfort zone and you get into this growth zone and you feel like you have to be perfect, like I'm going to do this and I have to be amazing at it, that's going to be scary and stressful. But if you're like, you know what? I'm going to give this a try for 18 months. I'm going to give this a try for 2 years. I'm going to give this a try this summer, whatever the time frame is. I'm going to give it a try. I have never done this before. I am going to do my best to learn what I can. I'm going to talk to people who know about this, and I'm just going to try to learn and grow. It's putting on that growth mindset hat that I, with my effort, am capable of learning more and getting better at things instead of I have to be perfect. And so taking a little bit of those risks and putting that growth mindset hat on, I think that's the way. And knowing, if you will believe me, you know, you have to sort of take my word for it, but on the other side of scary is exhilarating. And that, frankly, that's where I like to lead my life. I like to be slightly terrified and slightly exhilarated. I like to ride that edge because I don't want to be bored. I don't want to be complacent. I don't want to be like, yep, oh yeah, my life, it's good. I mean, it is a privilege to have choices. It is a privilege to be entertaining this, like, what should I do with my life? I acknowledge that. There are plenty of people who are like, I just need to get the bills paid and whatever job I can get to take care of business I'm going to get. Once we're middle class, we tend to have a set of options, maybe more options than we realize. And even if we're in a lower socioeconomic bracket, I'm not saying you don't have options. I'm just acknowledging it might be a lot more difficult to just sort of branch out in something that feels a little risky because you're living a little bit closer to the edge to start with.
Nice. We've talked about some different themes here, having a growth mindset, self-love, self-direction, not listening to those outside voices, taking risks, getting out of our comfort zone. You interviewed a ton of people. for your turn, and from very diverse backgrounds, what were the themes that emerged from what helped propel people forward?
Thank you for mentioning that. It's one of the aspects of the book that I think some readers will overlook, but some are very hungry for. This is a book that says, if we're going to talk about a stage of life all humans go through, we got to put examples of all different kinds of humans in these pages. My sincerest hope is that every reader has cause to say at some point, she had me in mind when she wrote this paragraph, this page, this chapter, whatever it might be, this sentence. I'm hoping for that because as a Black and biracial person, I know what it's like to not be seen on the page, to have it, to be reading something that purports to be for everybody, but it's clear the author is focused on, say, white folks. So what did I learn? Well, I learned, or I had reinforced, how gorgeous it is when people will open up and be vulnerable and share their tale, because it makes the listener feel less alone. We all feel more connected to one another when we can dare to say, you know what, I went through this. Another thing I learned, a lot of people get a lot of clarity around about age 14. I did not expect this, but I've interviewed 31 people who exist in the end of each chapter called Don't Just Take It From Me, you know, meet this person, that person. A good number of them had some kind of important epiphany that happened to them at age 14. And I don't know why that is, but I imagine there's just enough self-awareness coming at age 14 and a tremendous idealism about how the world should work. Not yet jaded, but pretty, you know, starting to be self-aware. And that's probably, you know, a really wonderful opportunity for combustion of ideas and a sense of this is what matters and this is what I should be doing.
When we received your book, I remember going through the packaging, which was beautiful, by the way. And there was this card that listed all of the different kinds of people that you interviewed for this book. And that just, like, it just really made my day and made that your book so interesting to me, especially in this time that we're living in, where we're some people are really struggling to be seen and other people are really trying to push those people up to the front. And I just really, really appreciated that you were very upfront about the diversity of your book and how diverse it is in so many different ways.
Alana, thank you for that. That is exactly what I'm hoping will happen. So for you, you know, you were able to appreciate that and recognize what I was doing. I think for many readers, they won't necessarily get that I was doing it explicitly, but they'll learn a thing or two about people that are different from them. And I think what I'm trying to do is expand our notion, like humans actually come in all shapes and sizes and varieties. Let's lean into that and demonstrate that. But in telling all these stories, let's realize we're also similar. We all bleed. We all dream. We all occasionally are ashamed of choices we made. We struggle. We yearn. We want love. We want to be seen. We want to know we matter. We want to be treated with dignity and kindness and have opportunity. So that's a little bit of the subversive tack I'm taking in this book on adulting, a stage of life all humans go through if we survive childhood. You know, is this like, and let's actually learn a little bit more about the panoply of humans that comprise the human community. I mean, I had this intention many years ago. It happens that I'm now launching this book in a time in America when a greater number of people than has been the case in a long time are attuned to the fact that we are an incredibly diverse community here in America with folks who have very disparate experiences on the basis of our immutable identities and characteristics. And, you know, I hope that ultimately, I mean, this is a real subversive element of the book. I'm trying to build empathy. You know, the book, the opening story is a kid in Appalachia who grew up with a single mom who was addicted to opioids. If that isn't ripped out of the headlines, I don't know what is. There's also, you know, an African-American male in this book who was at college at a fraternity party and someone had a fight and the police came and decided he was the wrongdoer and drew guns on him. And, you know, unfortunately, these are lived experiences. There's a guy in this book who was at what folks thought of as a lower tier college, but he was determined to get the opportunities with an investment bank only offered to the higher tier college kids across the Charles River. He was at Northeastern. The kids at Harvard were getting this opportunity to interview with an investment bank at the bar where he was working part-time. And he said to his boss, when that private party for the Harvard kids happens, I want my shift to be that night. And so he rearranged his schedule, worked the shift, served the Harvard kids and the investment bankers beautifully. And when the investment banking partner came over to shake his hand and say, thank you so much, here's a big fat cash tip, he smiled and said, I appreciate it. I don't want your tip. I want to hand you my resume. He had two copies of it stashed behind the bar, two copies in case one got splashed with drinks. And he said, please give my resume to your hiring partner. I would love an opportunity to work with you. He did get hired. They called him tier two all summer because he was from the tier two school. They were all tier one. He was the only tier two hired. He went on to excel in his career. And he's in there because he's an example of hustling. He started life as a working class kid. He is now a senior vice president of amazingness in some bank. He's also in there because he and his wife struggled with infertility. They tried and tried and tried medical intervention, miscarriages, heartache. And he ultimately switched careers to a career in virtual reality. He called me back to say, Julie, I didn't tell you the full truth of that career switch. I switched to VR because I wanted to create an environment in which I could have a child. Okay, augmented reality, virtual reality. He's like, I did that for a while. It was not satisfying in terms of what I was really trying to sate, which was the need to be a father. That story moves on to adoption. That story moves on to biological kid being conceived and born. Once the stress around trying to have a kid, they finally got an adopted baby. You know, once their family felt complete, then they conceived their own child. So this guy is in my book telling that story, which is not a story you typically hear guys tell. You know, the senior vice president of whatever will tell you being vulnerable about these personal struggles has been one of the most important aspects of his life. Being of service to others by sharing this story of hardship really matters to him. So there's a lot going on in these stories.
Yeah. And it's so important. I think that sharing our stories and hearing the stories of other people really taps into one of the deepest parts of us. As humans, like gathering around the campfire as like early cave people, and helping to connect us, helping to build empathy, recognizing that even though we might look different on the outside, that we have so many similarities on the inside. And I feel like with this book, with our conversation, we have just like scratched the surface. I want people to buy your book for their teens, for themselves, in how it has the potential to open up some really wonderful conversations. Can you tell a story about another mom and son, I think, before we started?
Absolutely.
About how they're using your work to open up conversations as we're wrapping up.
Absolutely. So, Alana, I was thrilled that you wanted to be a part of this convo. I really am deeply interested in what you think about this book. I care about you, of course, Cecilia, as well. But Alana, you are in the target audience in terms of for whom this book was written. The narrative that I tried to come up with is trying to envision, like, what would it be like to be sitting with you in your house, you know, listening to you as you kind of riff on the ways in which you're stressed about striking out on your own or choosing a major or choosing what to do next after high school or whatever. And I did have an early reader pair, a mom and her 18-year-old son. And the mom let me know, she, you know, got in touch with me and said, my son is actually wanting to talk with me about subjects in this book. She says the book is sort of opening that door between parent and child that the parents want to push open and the child often wants to keep shut, you know, that the book is pushing the door open. The son is saying, hey, mom, we need to talk about what's on page, whatever. And I just went like this, like, yes, that if my book can help be a conduit for young adults to express what's in their hearts, what's on their minds, what they're concerned about, what they want to seek guidance and advice about, what they want to question and critique. If the book can facilitate them in having that conversation with the people they love and trust the most and want some guidance and approval from, boy, that would be a huge vote of confidence for this book. So I'm hoping that it proves to be that for a lot of parents and young adults.
It is proving to be that way for me, even though I am not reading this with my parents. My mom is behind me in the book currently. It just has opened so many doors for me in my brain, and I've come up with so many different conversations that I've asked my parents about, and I have just fallen in love with this book, and it really does feel like you're sitting there telling me what to do with my life in a good way.
In a good way. I'm not telling you what to do. I'm trying to tell you how to think about
exactly.
It, right? Can you, not to put you too much on the spot, but to totally put you on the spot, you know, is there, like you just said, this has opened up opportunities for, you know, in your own brain for conversations with your kid, with your parents. Can you give one example of a way in which reading something made you go, oh, I'm going to check in with my parents about this, or I'm going to raise this with them?
I can't quite remember. I know I've talked to Jason about things, but I can't remember anything that I say. I know it has opened a lot of doors in my mind about like what my professional life will look like after college and how to interact with colleagues and things like that. And I know a lot about what my parents do for work, and I think I have a pretty good understanding of it. But even in reading your book, for some reason, it has helped me understand it more. And like their online business, I've somehow understood it more through your book.
Good. I'm glad.
I would say also that you're asking questions about like when to transition to the new thing. How do you know when to change a job or leave a relationship? That's one of the things that you've covered. Even smaller things like networking.
Yeah.
And how you connect with people and build that professional network. It's covering topics that I wouldn't have thought about in my parenting, that your book is filling the gap, because there are things that I just didn't know that I should be helping Alana with. And I just want to like read like the table of contents.
Wait, before you do that.
Okay, go.
I am at a really interesting point in my life because I'm graduating high school and I've just gotten accepted to colleges, and I'm trying to decide what college to go to. And I'm going to college next year. And your book has come to me in the perfect time in my life, because for me, that's a really scary decision to make, because I want to make that decision right. Mm. And your book has provided so much guidance about thinking about my life and how I want to create my life into something that I love and enjoy, and thinking about what college I want to go to, and helping me think about that growth and that growth mindset. And it just has really, I felt very supported by your book in this time of change.
I'm so glad to hear that. And here's what I want you to know. The more you know yourself, the better things are. You will take that self with you wherever you choose to go. There is not a single college that is the solitary lone one right one for you. Okay. It's more like a spectrum, like, oh, these would be horrible for me. I could probably be just fine here and I might really thrive here. And there's probably a set of things there. Okay. So let yourself off the hook in terms of the pressure of I've got to figure out which one is perfect. Mm-mm. And listen to that inner, that gut that's telling you, I could be myself there. That's probably, if you can discern how you feel in response to that question, where can you be yourself? Forget what everybody else is saying about what they offer and what it's like. Like, what is your body and mind in combination telling you is a place where you can be yourself? Yes, you want to be challenged, you want opportunity. All of that is going to happen wherever you go to college, okay? Where can I be myself? Because when you feel you can be yourself, meaning I'm accepted here, people like me belong here, whatever that means to you, then you're more likely to lean into the opportunities they offer and really reach for the stars, but you're also likely to get support and seek out resources to the extent you're struggling, which many of us do at college. I struggled mightily when I first got to college. One of the reasons I became a dean was to support all the students coming up behind me, you know, in the next generation who were going to struggle at some point. Struggle is natural. It happens. So where, if you feel you belong, you're more likely to go for help and go for opportunities. I'm excited for you. I can't wait for you to embark upon this next step in your journey.
Thank you. I'm excited too.
Good.
And I just want to say, like, your book is filling that gap. It's like no other book that I have read yet in helping young people step into who they're meant to be in the world and find ways to belong, find ways to listen to themselves. And for me, as a parent, knowing that Alana is reading this book and getting chapters like on, like, not stop pleasing others, on networking and talking to strangers, on even money matters, letting go of perfectionism, identifying her superpowers. Like, this is such a gold mine. Alana was reading it and she was giggling and laughing in her room. She thought it was so funny. She was like, oh my gosh, can Julie be my friend?
I love it.
So readable, relatable. So I'm just ecstatic that you are in the world and that you have gifted us with this book. As we're wrapping up, I wonder if there is a message that you have, not just for like the average teen that's struggling with life transitions and stuff, but maybe even someone who is listening to this and is socioeconomically is disadvantaged, racially is disadvantaged, sexual orientation is disadvantaged, coming from one of those backgrounds. Is there a particular message that you have for that person?
Absolutely. Thanks for the opportunity. My message is, I see you, you matter. The older you get, the more you will have choice over the communities in which you will live and work. And you will, as they say with the Trevor Project, it gets better. Often our home community, some of us, our families are not accepting of who we are, or our school community, or our neighborhood, or our town. The older you get, the more you're in charge of locating yourself. And I'm saying to you, choose places and spaces where you can be cherished as you are. Okay? You deserve to be cherished. We all do. We can all find ourselves in community with people who get us, love us, like us, appreciate us, even with all that's wrong with us, because there's something wrong with all, like, none of us is perfect, right? So with that intentionality that comes with age and stage of life, seek out communities where you can thrive. For example, I had a student who was going to go to med school. He was a queer Indian American male, and he chose a medical school that had a thriving queer community. 4 years of medical school is a long time to be, you know, feeling like you have to be closeted around a very important aspect of your identity. So choose spaces, work, and community in terms of living where you can thrive.
Julie, as we're wrapping up here, do you have a big ask for the community, or is there anything that we didn't cover?
I won't make an ask, but what I do want to say in terms of covering is, one in two 18-year-olds today has a diagnosis of a learning difference or a mental health condition, and that's a real sea change from when I was growing up. And I really normalize that in the book. So I want anyone who's listening who might have a diagnosis or doesn't yet or may never have a diagnosis but has a situation that makes learning more challenging, makes being around humans more challenging, makes going through the world that is often not accommodating more challenging, I want you to know that I have you in mind as I've put this book together, and how folks cope with anxiety, how folks cope with depression, bipolar disorder, OCD, eating disorders. Those are some examples of the stories that you will find in this book. It's another aspect of the inclusivity that I was really aiming for, in addition to race and class, et cetera. So I just wanted to be clear about that.
I love that. You created a book that is an inclusive space for everyone and gives everyone a place to belong.
Nice. Thank you.
And for people who are listening, who want to find out more about your work, want to read your books, where should they go?
Awesome. Just go to my website, julielithcott-hames.com, and you can connect with everything about me there. My social handles are all at jlithcott-hames. I'm on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter, maybe even TikTok, although I probably shouldn't get on TikTok, right? I'm too old, but who knows? I might try. But anyway, if I am on TikTok, it'll be jlithcott-hames. It's just how you can find me everywhere. And Julie Lithcott-Hames is the website.
Awesome. Thank you, Julie, so much for taking the time to talk to us today, for your book, your books, and for the gift that you are to the world to create a place where we can all belong and succeed and step into who we're meant to be. Thank you.
Cecilia, thank you. Alana, this was huge having you here. Thank you. With all your graduating from high school and you took the time to read my enormous book, which just, I'm so glad it sounds like it proved itself worthy of your time, which just fills my heart enormously as an author. And to see parent and child discussing this stuff together is very, very edifying. So thanks to both of you and to Jason, of course, for just, you know, being in dialogue with me today. I'm really grateful.
I'm looking forward to speaking to you again. Take care. Bye-bye.